This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking by Daniel C. Dennett, performed by Jeff Crawford. For Tufts University, my academic home. 1. Introduction. What is an intuition pump? You can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, and you can't do much thinking with your bare brain. Bo Dalbum. Thinking is hard. Thinking about some problems is so hard it can make your head ache just thinking about them. My colleague, the neuropsychologist Marcel Kinsborn, suggests that whenever we find thinking hard, it is because the stony path to truth is competing with seductive, easier paths that turn out to be dead ends. Most of the effort in thinking is a matter of resisting these temptations. We keep getting waylaid and have to steel ourselves for the task at hand. Ugh. There's a famous story about John von Neumann, the mathematician and physicist who turned Alan Turing's idea, what we now call a Turing machine, into an actual electronic computer, what we now call a von Neumann machine, such as your laptop or smartphone. Von Neumann was a virtuoso thinker, legendary for his lightning capacity for doing prodigious calculations in his head. According to the story, and like most famous stories, this one has many versions, a colleague approached him one day with a puzzle that had two paths to a solution, a laborious, complicated calculation, and an elegant, aha-type solution. This colleague had a theory. In such a case, mathematicians work out the laborious solution, while the lazier but smarter physicists pause and find the quick and easy solution. Which solution would von Neumann find? You know the sort of puzzle. Two trains, 100 miles apart, are approaching each other on the same track, one going 30 miles per hour, the other going 20 miles per hour. A bird flying 120 miles per hour starts at train A, when they are 100 miles apart, flies to train B, turns around and flies back to the approaching train A, and so forth until the two trains collide. How far has the bird flown when the collision occurs? 240 miles, von Neumann answered almost instantly. Darn, replied his colleague. I predicted you'd do it the hard way, summing the infinite series. Aye, von Neumann cried in embarrassment, smiting his forehead. There's an easy way? Hint. How long until the trains collide? Some people, like von Neumann, are such natural geniuses that they can breeze through the toughest tangles. Others are more plodding, but are blessed with a heroic supply of willpower that helps them stay the course in their dogged pursuit of truth. Then there are the rest of us, not calculating prodigies and a little bit lazy, but still aspiring to understand whatever confronts us. What can we do? We can use thinking tools by the dozens. These handy prosthetic imagination extenders and focus holders permit us to think reliably and even gracefully about really hard questions. This book is a collection of my favorite thinking tools. I will not just describe them. I intend to use them to move your mind gently through uncomfortable territory all the way to a quite radical vision of meaning, mind, and free will. We will begin with some tools that are simple in general, having applications to all sorts of topics. Some of these are familiar, but others have not been much noticed or discussed. Then I will introduce you to some tools that are for very special purposes indeed, designed to explode one specific seductive idea or another, clearing a way out of a deep rut that still traps and flummoxes experts. We will also encounter and dismantle a variety of bad thinking tools, misbegotten persuasion devices that can lead you astray if you aren't careful. Whether or not you arrive comfortably at my proposed destination and decide to stay there with me, the journey will equip you with new ways of thinking about the topics and thinking about thinking. The physicist Richard Feynman was perhaps an even more legendary genius than von Neumann, and he was certainly endowed with a world-class brain. But he also loved having fun, and we can all be grateful that he particularly enjoyed revealing the tricks of the trade he used to make life easier for himself. No matter how smart you are, you're smarter if you take the easy ways when they are available. His autobiographical books, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and What Do You Care What Other People Think, should be on the required reading list of every aspiring thinker, since they have many hints about how to tame the toughest problems, and even how to dazzle an audience with fakery when nothing better comes to mind. Inspired by the wealth of useful observations in his books, and his candor in revealing how his mind worked, I decided to try my own hand at a similar project, less autobiographical and with the ambitious goal of persuading you to think about these topics my way. I will go to considerable lengths to cajole you out of some of your firmly held convictions, but with nothing up my sleeve. One of my main goals is to reveal along the way just what I am doing and why. Like all artisans, a blacksmith needs tools, but, according to an old, indeed almost extinct observation, blacksmiths are unique in that they make their own tools. Carpenters don't make their saws and hammers, tailors don't make their scissors and needles, and plumbers don't make their wrenches, but blacksmiths can make their hammers, tongs, anvils, and chisels out of their raw material, iron. What about thinking tools? Who makes them? And what are they made of? Philosophers have made some of the best of them out of nothing but ideas, useful structures of information. René Descartes gave us Cartesian coordinates, the X and Y axes, without which calculus, a thinking tool par excellence, simultaneously invented by Isaac Newton and the philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, would be almost unthinkable. Blaise Pascal gave us probability theory, so we can easily calculate the odds of various wagers. The Reverend Thomas Bayes was also a talented mathematician, and he gave us Bayes' theorem, the backbone of Bayesian statistical thinking. But most of the tools that feature in this book are simpler ones, not the precise systematic machines of mathematics and science, but the hand tools of the mind. Among them are labels. Sometimes just creating a vivid name for something helps you keep track of it while you turn it around in your mind, trying to understand it. Among the most useful labels, as we shall see, are warning labels or alarms, which alert us to likely sources of error. Examples. Some philosophers think that using examples in their work is, if not quite cheating, at least uncalled for, rather the way novelists shun illustrations in their novels. The novelists take pride in doing it all with words, and the philosophers take pride in doing it all with carefully crafted abstract generalizations presented in rigorous order, as close to mathematical proofs as they can muster. Good for them, but they can't expect me to recommend their work to any but a few remarkable students. It's just more difficult than it has to be. Analogies and metaphors. Mapping the features of one complex thing onto the features of another complex thing that you already think you understand is a famously powerful thinking tool. But it is so powerful that it often leads thinkers astray when their imaginations get captured by a treacherous analogy. Staging. You can shingle a roof, paint a house, or fix a chimney with the help of just a ladder, moving it and climbing, moving it and climbing, getting access to only a small part of the job at a time. But it's often a lot easier in the end to take the time at the beginning to erect some sturdy staging that will allow you to move swiftly and safely around the whole project. Several of the most valuable thinking tools in this book are examples of staging that take some time to put in place, but then permit a variety of problems to be tackled together without all the ladder moving. And finally, the sort of thought experiments I have dubbed intuition pumps. Thought experiments are among the favorite tools of philosophers, not surprisingly. Who needs a lab when you can figure out the answer to your question by some ingenious deduction? Scientists from Galileo to Einstein and beyond have also used thought experiments to good effect. So these are not just philosophers' tools. Some thought experiments are analyzable as rigorous arguments, often of the form reductio ad absurdum, in which one takes one's opponent's premise and derives a formal contradiction, an absurd result, showing that they can't all be right. One of my favorites is the proof attributed to Galileo that heavy things don't fall faster than lighter things, when friction is negligible. If they did, he argued, then since heavy stone A would fall faster than light stone B, if we tied B to A, stone B would act as a drag, slowing A down. But A tied to B is heavier than A alone, so the two together should also fall faster than A by itself. We have concluded that tying B to A would make something that fell both faster and slower than A by itself, which is a contradiction. Other thought experiments are less rigorous, but often just as effective. Little stories designed to provoke a heartfelt, table-thumping intuition. Yes, of course it has to be so, about whatever thesis is being defended. I have called these intuition pumps. I coined the term in the first of my public critiques of philosopher John Searle's famous Chinese Room thought experiment, Searle 1980, Dennett 1980. And some thinkers concluded I meant the term to be disparaging or dismissive. On the contrary, I love intuition pumps. That is, some intuition pumps are excellent, some are dubious, and only a few are downright deceptive. Intuition pumps have been a dominant force in philosophy for centuries. They are the philosopher's version of Aesop's fables, which have been recognized as wonderful thinking tools since before there were philosophers. If you ever studied philosophy in college, you were probably exposed to such classics as Plato's Cave in the Republic, in which people are chained and can see only the shadows of real things cast on the cave wall, or his example in Meno of teaching geometry to the slave boy. Then there's Descartes' evil demon, deceiving Descartes into believing in a world that was entirely illusory, the original virtual reality thought experiment, and Hobbes' State of Nature, in which life is nasty, brutish, and short. Not as famous as Aesop's Boy Who Cried Wolf or The Ant and the Grasshopper, but still widely known, each is designed to pump some intuitions. Plato's Cave purports to enlighten us about the nature of perception and reality, and The Slave Boy is supposed to illustrate our innate knowledge. The Evil Demon is the ultimate skepticism generator, and our improvement over the state of nature when we contract to form a society is the point of Hobbes's parable. These are the enduring melodies of philosophy, with the staying power that ensures that students will remember them quite vividly and accurately years after they have forgotten the intricate surrounding arguments and analysis. A good intuition pump is more robust than any one version of it. We will consider a variety of contemporary intuition pumps, including some defective ones, and the goal will be to understand what they're good for, how they work, how to use them, and even how to make them. Here's a short, simple example. The whimsical jailer. Every night, he waits until all the prisoners are sound asleep, and then he goes around unlocking all the doors, leaving them open for hours on end. Question: are the prisoners free? Do they have an opportunity to leave? Not really. Why not? Here's another example. The jewels in the trash can. There happens to be a fortune in jewelry discarded in the trash can on the sidewalk that you stroll by one night. It might seem that you have a golden opportunity to become rich, except it isn't golden at all because it is a bare opportunity, one that you would be extremely unlikely to recognize and hence act on or even consider. These two simple scenarios pump intuitions that might not otherwise be obvious. The importance of getting timely information about genuine opportunities soon enough for the information to cause us to consider it in time to do something about it. In our eagerness to make free choices, uncaused, we'd like to think, by external forces, we tend to forget that we shouldn't want to be cut off from all such forces. Free will does not abhor our embedding in a rich causal context. It actually requires it. I hope you feel that there is more to be said on that topic. These tiny intuition pumps raise an issue vividly, but they don't settle anything. Yet. A whole section will concentrate on free will later. We need to become practiced in the art of treating such tools warily, watching where we step and checking for pitfalls. If we think of an intuition pump as a carefully designed persuasion tool, we can see that it might repay us to reverse engineer the tool, checking out all the moving parts to see what they are doing. When Doug Hofstadter and I composed The Mind's Eye back in 1982, he came up with just the right advice on this score. Consider the intuition pump to be a tool with many settings and turn all the knobs to see if the same intuitions still get pumped when you consider variations. So let's identify and turn the knobs on the whimsical jailer. Assume, until proved otherwise, that every part has a function, and see what that function is by replacing it with another part or transforming it slightly. 1. Every night. 2. He waits. 3. Until all the prisoners. 4. Are sound asleep. 5. And then he goes around unlocking. 6. All the doors. 7. Leaving them open for hours on end. Here is one of the many variations we could consider. One night, he ordered his guards to drug one of the prisoners, and after they had done this, they accidentally left the door of that prisoner's cell unlocked for an hour. It changes the flavor of the scenario quite a lot, doesn't it? How? It still makes the main point, doesn't it? But not as effectively. The big difference seems to be between being naturally asleep, you might wake up any minute, and being drugged or comatose. Another difference, accidentally, highlights the role of the intention or inadvertence on the part of the jailer or the guards. The repetition, every night, seems to change the odds in favor of the prisoners. When and why do the odds matter? How much would you pay not to have to participate in a lottery in which 1 million people have tickets and the winner is shot? How much would you pay not to have to play Russian roulette with a six-shooter? Here we use one intuition pump to illuminate another, a trick to remember. Other knobs to turn are less obvious. The diabolical host secretly locks the bedroom doors of his house guests while they sleep. The hospital manager, worried about the prospect of a fire, keeps the doors of all the rooms and wards unlocked at night, but she doesn't inform the patients, thinking they will sleep more soundly if they don't know. Or what if the prison is somewhat larger than usual, say the size of Australia? You can't lock or unlock all the doors to Australia. What difference does that make? This self-conscious wariness with which we should approach any intuition pump is itself an important tool for thinking, the philosopher's favorite tactic, going meta, thinking about thinking, talking about talking, reasoning about reasoning. Meta-language is the language we use to talk about another language, and meta-ethics is a bird's-eye view examination of ethical theories. As I once said to Doug, anything you can do, I can do meta. This whole book is, of course, an example of going meta, exploring how to think carefully about methods of thinking carefully, about methods of thinking carefully, etc. He recently, in 2007, offered a list of some of his own favorite small hand tools. Wild goose chases. Tackiness. Dirty tricks. Sour grapes. Elbow grease. Feet of clay. Loose cannons. Crackpots. Lip service. Slam dunks. Feedback. If these expressions are familiar to you, they are not just words for you. Each is an abstract cognitive tool, in the same way that long division or finding the average is a tool. Each has a role to play in a broad spectrum of contexts, making it easier to formulate hypotheses to test, making it easier to recognize unnoticed patterns in the world, helping the user look for important similarities and so forth. Every word in your vocabulary is a simple thinking tool, but some are more useful than others. If any of these expressions are not in your kit, you might want to acquire them. Equipped with such tools, you will be able to think thoughts that would otherwise be relatively hard to formulate. Of course, as the old saw has it, when your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And each of these tools can be overused. Let's look at just one of these, sour grapes. It comes from Aesop's fable, The Fox and the Grapes, and draws attention to how sometimes people pretend not to care about something they can't have by disparaging it. Look how much you can say about what somebody has just said by asking simply, sour grapes? It gets her to consider a possibility that might otherwise have gone unnoticed, and this might very effectively inspire her to revise her thinking, or reflect on the issue from a wider perspective, or it might very effectively insult her. Tools can be used as weapons, too. So familiar is the moral of the story that you may have forgotten the tale leading up to it and may have lost touch with the subtleties, if they matter, and sometimes they don't. Acquiring tools and using them wisely are distinct skills, but you have to start by acquiring the tools or making them yourself. Many of the thinking tools I will present here are my own inventions, but others I have acquired from others, and I will acknowledge their inventors in due course. None of the tools on Doug's list are his inventions, but he has contributed some fine specimens to my kit, such as Jutsingen's Svexishness. Some of the most powerful thinking tools are mathematical, but aside from mentioning them, I will not devote much space to them, because this is a book celebrating the power of non-mathematical tools, informal tools, the tools of prose and poetry, if you like, a power that scientists often underestimate. You can see why. First, there is a culture of scientific writing in research journals that favors, indeed insists on, an impersonal, stripped-down presentation of the issues with a minimum of flourish, rhetoric, and allusion. There's a good reason for the relentless drabness in the pages of our most serious scientific journals. As one of my doctoral examiners, the neuroanatomist J.Z. Young, wrote to me in 1965 in objecting to the somewhat fanciful prose in my dissertation at Oxford, in philosophy, not neuroanatomy, English was becoming the international language of science, and it behooves us native English speakers to write words that can be read by a patient Chinese with a good dictionary. The results of this self-imposed discipline speak for themselves. Whether you are a Chinese, German, Brazilian, or even a French scientist, you insist on publishing your most important work in English, bare-bones English, translatable with minimal difficulty, relying as little as possible on cultural allusions, nuances, wordplay, and even metaphor. The level of mutual understanding achieved by this international system is invaluable, but there is a price to be paid. Some of the thinking that has to be done apparently requires informal metaphor mongering and imagination tweaking, assaulting the barricades of closed minds with every trick in the book. And if some of this cannot be easily translated, then I will just have to hope for virtuoso translators on the one hand, and the growing fluency in English of the world's scientists on the other. Another reason why scientists are often suspicious of theoretical discussions conducted in mere words is that they recognize that the task of criticizing an argument not formulated in mathematical equations is much trickier and typically less conclusive. The language of mathematics is a reliable enforcer of cogency. It's like the net on the basketball hoop. It removes sources of disagreement and judgment about whether the ball went in. Anyone who has played basketball on a playground court with a bare hoop knows how hard it can be to tell an air ball from a basket. But sometimes the issues are just too slippery and baffling to be tamed by mathematics. I have always figured that if I can't explain something I'm doing to a group of bright undergraduates, I don't really understand it myself. And that challenge has shaped everything I have written. Some philosophy professors yearn to teach advanced seminars only to graduate students. Not me. Graduate students are often too eager to prove to each other and to themselves that they are savvy operators, wielding the jargon of their trade with deft assurance, baffling outsiders. That's how they assure themselves that what they are doing requires expertise, and showing off their ability to pick their way through the most tortuous and torturous technical arguments without getting lost. Philosophy written for one's advanced graduate students and fellow experts is typically all but unreadable, and hence, largely unread. A curious side effect of my policy of trying to write arguments and explanations that can be readily understood by people outside philosophy departments is that there are philosophers who, as a matter of principle, won't take my arguments seriously. When I gave the John Locke lectures at Oxford many years ago to a standing room only audience, a distinguished philosopher was heard to grumble as he left one of them that he was damned if he would learn anything from somebody who could attract non-philosophers to the Locke lectures. True to his word, he never learned anything from me, so far as I can tell. I did not adjust my style and have never regretted paying the price. There is a time and a place in philosophy for rigorous arguments, with all the premises numbered and the inference rules named, but these do not often need to be paraded in public. We ask our graduate students to prove that they can do it in their dissertations, and some never outgrow the habit, unfortunately. And to be fair, the opposite sin of high-flown continental rhetoric, larded with literary ornament and intimations of profundity, does philosophy no favors either. If I had to choose, I'd take the hard-bitten, analytic logic chopper over the deep purple sage every time. At least you can usually figure out what the logic chopper is talking about and what would count as being wrong. The middle ground, roughly halfway between poetry and mathematics, is where philosophers can make their best contributions, I believe, yielding genuine clarifications of deeply puzzling problems. There are no feasible algorithms for doing this kind of work. Since everything is up for grabs, one chooses one's fixed points with due caution. As often as not, an innocent assumption accepted without notice on all sides turns out to be the culprit. Exploring such treacherous conceptual territories is greatly aided by using thinking tools devised on the spot to clarify the alternative paths and shed light on their prospects. These thinking tools seldom establish a fixed point, a solid axiom for all future inquiry, but rather introduce a worthy candidate for a fixed point, a likely constraint on future inquiry, but itself subject to revision or jettisoning altogether if somebody can figure out why. No wonder many scientists have no taste at all for philosophy. Everything is up for grabs. Nothing is take it to the bank secure. And the intricate webs of argument constructed to connect these fixed points hang provisionally in the air, untethered to clear foundations of empirical proof or falsification. So these scientists turn their backs on philosophy and get on with their work, but at the cost of leaving some of the most important and fascinating questions unconsidered. Don't ask, don't tell. It's premature to tackle the problem of consciousness, of free will, of morality, of meaning and creativity. But few can live with such abstemiousness. And in recent years, scientists have set out on a gold rush of sorts into these shunned regions, seduced by sheer curiosity, or sometimes perhaps a yearning for celebrity. They embark on the big questions and soon discover how hard it is to make progress on them. I must confess that one of the delicious, if guilty, pleasures I enjoy is watching eminent scientists who only a few years ago expressed withering contempt for philosophy stumble embarrassingly in their own efforts to set the world straight on these matters, with a few briskly argued extrapolations from their own scientific research. Even better is when they request and acknowledge a little help from us philosophers. In the first section that follows, I present a dozen general, all-purpose tools, and then in subsequent sections, I group the rest of the entries not by the type of tool, but by the topic where the tool works best, turning first to the most fundamental philosophical topic, meaning or content, followed by evolution, consciousness, and free will. A few of the tools I present are actual software, friendly devices that can do for your naked imagination what telescopes and microscopes can do for your naked eye. Along the way, I will also introduce some false friends, tools that blow smoke instead of shining light. I needed a term for these hazardous devices, and I found le mot juste in my sailing experience. Many sailors enjoy the nautical terms that baffle landlubbers: port and starboard, gudgeon and pintle, shrouds and spreaders, kringles and fairleads, and all the rest. A running joke on a boat I once sailed on involved making up false definitions for these terms. So a binnacle was a marine growth on compasses, and a mast tang was a citrus beverage enjoyed aloft. A snatch block was a female defensive maneuver, and a boom crutch was an explosive orthopedic device. I've never since been able to think of a boom crutch, a removable wooden stand on which the boom rests when the sail is lowered, without a momentary image of kapow in some poor fellow's armpit. So I chose the term as my name for thinking tools that backfire, the ones that only seem to aid in understanding, but that actually spread darkness and confusion instead of light. Scattered through these chapters are a variety of boom crutches with suitable warning labels and examples to deplore. And I close with some further reflections on what it is like to be a philosopher, in case anybody wants to know, including some advice from Uncle Dan to any of you who might have discovered a taste for this way of investigating the world and wonder whether you are cut out for a career in the field. 2. A dozen general thinking tools. Most of the thinking tools in this book are quite specialized, made to order for application to a particular topic and even a particular controversy within the topic. But before we turn to these intuition pumps, here are a few general-purpose thinking tools, ideas, and practices that have proved themselves in a wide variety of contexts. 1. Making mistakes. He who says, "Better to go without belief forever than believe a lie," merely shows his own preponderant private horror of becoming a dupe. It is like a general informing his soldiers that it is better to keep out of battle forever than to risk a single wound. Not so are victories either over enemies or over nature gained. Our errors are surely not such awfully solemn things. In a world where we are so certain to incur them in spite of all our caution, a certain lightness of heart seems healthier than this excessive nervousness on their behalf. William James, The Will to Believe. If you've made up your mind to test a theory or you want to explain some idea, you should always decide to publish it, whichever way it comes out. If we only publish results of a certain kind, we can make the argument look good. We must publish both kinds of results. Richard Feynman, "Surely you're joking, Mr. Feynman." Scientists often ask me why philosophers devote so much of their effort to teaching and learning the history of their field. Chemists typically get by with only a rudimentary knowledge of the history of chemistry, picked up along the way. And many molecular biologists, it seems, are not even curious about what happened in biology before about 1950. My answer is that the history of philosophy is in large measure the history of very smart people making very tempting mistakes. And if you don't know the history, you are doomed to making the same darn mistakes all over again. That's why we teach the history of the field to our students, and scientists who blithely ignore philosophy do so at their own risk. There is no such thing as philosophy-free science, just science that has been conducted without any consideration of its underlying philosophical assumptions. The smartest or luckiest of the scientists sometimes manage to avoid the pitfalls quite adroitly. Perhaps they are natural-born philosophers, or are as smart as they think they are. But they are the rare exceptions. Not that professional philosophers don't make, and even defend, the old mistakes too. If the questions weren't hard, they wouldn't be worth working on. Sometimes you don't just want to risk making mistakes, you actually want to make them, if only to give you something clear and detailed to fix. Making mistakes is the key to making progress. Of course, there are times when it is really important not to make any mistakes. Ask any surgeon or airline pilot. But it is less widely appreciated that there are also times when making mistakes is the only way to go. Many of the students who arrive at very competitive universities pride themselves in not making mistakes. After all, that's how they've come so much farther than their classmates, or so they have been led to believe. I often find that I have to encourage them to cultivate the habit of making mistakes, the best learning opportunities of all. They get writer's block and waste hours forlornly wandering back and forth on the starting line. Blurt it out, I urge them. Then they have something on the page to work with. We philosophers are mistake specialists. I know it sounds like a bad joke, but hear me out. While other disciplines specialize in getting the right answers to their defining questions, we philosophers specialize in all the ways there are of getting things so mixed up, so deeply wrong, that nobody is even sure what the right questions are, let alone the answers. Asking the wrong questions risks setting any inquiry off on the wrong foot. Whenever that happens, this is a job for philosophers. Philosophy, in every field of inquiry, is what you have to do until you figure out what questions you should have been asking in the first place. Some people hate it when that happens. They would rather take their questions off the rack, all nicely tailored and pressed and cleaned and ready to answer. Those who feel that way can do physics or mathematics or history or biology. There's plenty of work for everybody. We philosophers have a taste for working on the questions that need to be straightened out before they can be answered. It's not for everyone. But try it. You might like it. In the course of this book, I am going to jump vigorously on what I claim are other people's mistakes. But I want to assure you that I am an experienced mistake maker myself. I've made some dillies, and hope to make a lot more. One of my goals in this book is to help you make good mistakes, the kind that light the way for everybody. First, the theory, and then the practice. Mistakes are not just opportunities for learning, they are, in an important sense, the only opportunity for learning or making something truly new. Before there can be learning, there must be learners. There are only two non-miraculous ways for learners to come into existence. They must either evolve or be designed and built by learners that evolved. Biological evolution proceeds by a grand, inexorable process of trial and error, and without the errors, the trials wouldn't accomplish anything. As Gore Vidal once said, "It is not enough to succeed, others must fail." Trials can be either blind or foresighted. You, who know a lot but not the answer to the question at hand, can take leaps, foresighted leaps. You can look before you leap and hence be somewhat guided from the outset by what you already know. You need not be guessing at random. But don't look down your nose at random guesses. Among its wonderful products is you. Evolution is one of the central themes of this book, as of all my books, for the simple reason that it is the central enabling process not only of life, but also of knowledge and learning and understanding. If you attempt to make sense of the world of ideas and meanings, free will and morality, art and science, and even philosophy itself without a sound and quite detailed knowledge of evolution, you have one hand tied behind your back. Later, we will look at some of the tools designed to help you think about some of the more challenging questions of evolution, but here we need to lay a foundation. For evolution, which knows nothing, the steps into novelty are blindly taken by mutations, which are random copying errors in DNA. Most of these typographical errors are of no consequence, since nothing reads them. They are as inconsequential as the rough drafts you didn't or don't hand in to the teacher for grading. The DNA of a species is rather like a recipe for building a new body, and most of the DNA is never actually consulted in the building process. It is often called junk DNA for just that reason. In the DNA sequences that do get read and acted upon during development, the vast majority of mutations are harmful. Many, in fact, are swiftly fatal. Since the majority of expressed mutations are deleterious, the process of natural selection actually works to keep the mutation rate very low. Each of you has very, very good copying machinery in your cells. For instance, you have roughly a trillion cells in your body, and each cell has either a perfect or an almost perfect copy of your genome, over 3 billion symbols long, the recipe for you that first came into existence when your parents' egg and sperm joined forces. Fortunately, the copying machinery does not achieve perfect success, for if it did, evolution would eventually grind to a halt, its sources of novelty dried up. Those tiny blemishes, those imperfections in the process, are the source of all the wonderful design and complexity in the living world. I can't resist adding, if anything deserves to be called original sin, these copying mistakes do. The chief trick to making good mistakes is not to hide them, especially not from yourself. Instead of turning away in denial when you make a mistake, you should become a connoisseur of your own mistakes, turning them over in your mind as if they were works of art, which in a way they are. The fundamental reaction to any mistake ought to be this: "Well, I won't do that again." Natural selection doesn't actually think the thought. It just wipes out the goofers before they can reproduce. Natural selection won't do that again. At least, not as often. Animals that can learn, learn not to make that noise, touch that wire, eat that food, have something with a similar selective force in their brains. B.F. Skinner and the behaviorists understood the need for this and called it reinforcement learning. That response is not reinforced and suffers extinction. We human beings carry matters to a much more swift and efficient level. We can actually think the thought, reflecting on what we have just done. "Well, I won't do that again." And when we reflect, we confront directly the problem that must be solved by any mistake maker. What exactly is that? What was it about what I just did that got me into all this trouble? The trick is to take advantage of the particular details of the mess you've made, so that your next attempt will be informed by it and not just another blind stab in the dark. We have all heard the forlorn refrain, "Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time." This phrase has come to stand for the rueful reflection of an idiot, a sign of stupidity. But in fact, we should appreciate it as a pillar of wisdom. Any being, any agent who can truly say, "Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time," is standing on the threshold of brilliance. We human beings pride ourselves on our intelligence, And one of its hallmarks is that we can remember our previous thinking and reflect on it, on how it seemed, on why it was tempting in the first place, and then about what went wrong. I know of no evidence to suggest that any other species on the planet can actually think this thought. If they could, they would be almost as smart as we are. So when you make a mistake, you should learn to take a deep breath, grit your teeth, and then examine your own recollections of the mistake as ruthlessly and dispassionately as you can manage. It's not easy. The natural human reaction to making a mistake is embarrassment and anger. We are never angrier than when we are angry at ourselves. And you have to work hard to overcome these emotional reactions. Try to acquire the weird practice of savoring your mistakes, delighting in uncovering the strange quirks that led you astray. Then, once you have sucked out all the goodness to be gained from having made them, you can cheerfully set them behind you and go on to the next big opportunity. But that is not enough. You should actively seek out opportunities to make grand mistakes, just so you can then recover from them. At its simplest, this is a technique we all learned in grade school. Recall how strange and forbidding long division seemed at first. You were confronted by two imponderably large numbers, and you had to figure out how to start. Does the divisor go into the dividend 6 or 7 or 8 times? Who knew? You didn't have to know. You just had to take a stab at it, whichever number you liked, and check out the result. I remember being almost shocked when I was told I should start by just making a guess. Wasn't this mathematics? You weren't supposed to play guessing games in such a serious business, were you? But eventually I appreciated, as we all do, the beauty of the tactic. If the chosen number turned out to be too small, you increased it and started over. If too large, you decreased it. The good thing about long division was that it always worked, even if you were maximally stupid in making your first choice, in which case it just took a little longer. This general technique of making a more or less educated guess, working out its implications, and using the result to make a correction for the next phase has found many applications. A key element of this tactic is making a mistake that is clear and precise enough to have definite implications. Before GPS came along, navigators used to determine their position at sea by first making a guess about where they were. They made a guess about exactly what their latitude and longitude were, and then calculating exactly how high in the sky the sun would appear to be if that were, by an incredible coincidence, their actual position. When they used this method, they didn't expect to hit the nail on the head. They didn't have to. Instead, they then measured the actual elevation angle of the sun exactly and compared the two values. With a little more trivial calculation, this told them how big a correction and in what direction to make their initial guess. In such a method, it is useful to make a pretty good guess the first time, but it doesn't matter that it is bound to be mistaken. The important thing is to make the mistake in glorious detail so there is something serious to correct. A GPS device uses the same guess and fix it strategy to locate itself relative to the overhead satellites. The more complex a problem you're facing, of course, the more difficult the analysis is. This is known to researchers in artificial intelligence, AI, as the problem of credit assignment. It could as well be called blame assignment. Figuring out what to credit and what to blame is one of the knottiest problems in AI, and it is also a problem faced by natural selection. Every organism on the earth dies sooner or later after one complicated life story or another. How on earth could natural selection see through the fog of all these details in order to figure out what positive factors to reward with offspring and what negative factors to punish with childless death? Can it really be that some of our ancestors' siblings died childless because their eyelids were the wrong shape? If not, how could the process of natural selection explain why our eyelids came to have the excellent shapes they have? Part of the answer is familiar. Following the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, leave almost all your old conservative design solutions in place and take your risks with a safety net in place. Natural selection automatically conserves whatever has worked up to now and fearlessly explores innovations large and small. The large ones almost always lead immediately to death. A terrible waste, but nobody's counting. Our eyelids were mostly designed by natural selection long before there were human beings or even primates or even mammals. They've had more than 100 million years to reach the shape they are today, with only a few minor touch-ups in the last 6 million years. Since we shared a common ancestor with the chimpanzees and the bonobos, another part of the answer is that natural selection works with large numbers of cases where even minuscule advantages show up statistically and can be automatically accumulated. Other parts of the answer are technicalities beyond this elementary discussion. Here's a technique that card magicians, at least the best of them, exploit with amazing results. I don't expect to incur the wrath of the magicians for revealing this trick to you, since this is not a particular trick, but a deep general principle. A good card magician knows many tricks that depend on luck. They don't always work, or even often work. There are some effects, they can hardly be called tricks, that might work only once in 1,000 times. Here's what you do. You start by telling the audience you are going to perform a trick, and without telling them what trick you are doing, you go for the 1 in 1,000 effect. It almost never works, of course, so you glide seamlessly into a second try, for an effect that works about 1 time in 100, perhaps. And when it too fails, as it almost always will, you slide gracefully into effect number 3, which works only about 1 time in 10, so you'd better be ready with effect number 4, which works half the time, let's say. If all else fails, and by this time, usually one of the earlier safety nets will have kept you out of the worst case, you have a fail-safe effect, which won't impress the crowd very much, but at least it's a surefire trick. In the course of a whole performance, you will be very unlucky indeed if you always have to rely on your final safety net. And whenever you achieve one of the higher-flying effects, the audience will be stupefied. Impossible! How on earth could you have known which was my card? Aha! You didn't know. But you had a cute way of taking a hopeful stab in the dark that paid off. By hiding all the mistake cases from view, the trials that didn't pan out, you create a miracle. Evolution works the same way. All the dumb mistakes tend to be invisible. So all we see is a stupendous string of triumphs. For instance, the vast majority, way over 90% of all the creatures that have ever lived, died childless. But not a single one of your ancestors suffered that fate. Talk about a line of charmed lives. One big difference between the discipline of science and the discipline of stage magic is that while magicians conceal their false starts from the audience as best they can, in science, you make your mistakes in public. You show them off so that everybody can learn from them. This way, you get the benefit of everybody else's experience and not just your own idiosyncratic path through the space of mistakes. The physicist Wolfgang Pauli famously expressed his contempt for the work of a colleague as not even wrong. A clear falsehood shared with critics is better than vague mush. This, by the way, is another reason why we humans are so much smarter than every other species. It is not so much that our brains are bigger or more powerful or even that we have the knack of reflecting on our own past errors, but that we share the benefits that our individual brains have won by their individual histories of trial and error. I am amazed at how many really smart people don't understand that you can make big mistakes in public and emerge none the worse for it. I know distinguished researchers who will go to preposterous lengths to avoid having to acknowledge that they were wrong about something. They have never noticed, apparently, that the earth does not swallow people up when they say, "Oops, you're right, I guess I made a mistake." Actually, people love it when somebody admits to making a mistake. All kinds of people love pointing out mistakes. Generous-spirited people appreciate your giving them the opportunity to help and acknowledging it when they succeed in helping you. Mean-spirited people enjoy showing you up. Let them. Either way, we all win. Of course, in general, people do not enjoy correcting the stupid mistakes of others. You have to have something worth correcting, something original to be right or wrong about, something that requires constructing the sort of pyramid of risky thinking we saw in the card magician's tricks. Carefully building on the works of others, you can get yourself cantilevered out on a limb of your own. And then there's a surprise bonus. If you are one of the big risk takers, people will get a kick out of correcting your occasional stupid mistakes, which show that you're not so special. You're a regular bungler like the rest of us. I know extremely careful philosophers who have never, apparently, made a mistake in their work. They tend not to get a whole lot accomplished, but what little they produce is pristine, if not venturesome. Their specialty is pointing out the mistakes of others, and this can be a valuable service. But nobody excuses their minor errors with a friendly chuckle. It is fair to say, unfortunately, that their best work often gets overshadowed and neglected, drowned out by the passing bandwagons driven by bolder thinkers. In Chapter 76, we'll see that the generally good practice of making bold mistakes has other unfortunate side effects as well. Meta advice? Don't take any advice too seriously. 2. By parity of reasoning, using reductio ad absurdum. The crowbar of rational inquiry, the great lever that enforces consistency, is reductio ad absurdum, literally, reduction of the argument to absurdity. You take the assertion or conjecture at issue and see if you can pry any contradictions, or just preposterous implications, out of it. If you can, that proposition has to be discarded or sent back to the shop for retooling. We do this all the time without bothering to display the underlying logic. If that's a bear, then bears have antlers. Or, he won't get here in time for supper unless he can fly like Superman. When the issue is a tricky theoretical controversy, the crowbar gets energetically wielded. But here, the distinction between fair criticism and refutation by caricature is hard to draw. Can your opponent really be so stupid as to believe the proposition you have just reduced to absurdity with a few deft moves? I once graded a student paper that had a serendipitous misspelling, replacing parity with parody, creating the delicious phrase by parody of reasoning. A handy name, I think, for misbegotten reductio ad absurdum arguments, which are all too common in the rough-and-tumble scientific and philosophical controversy. I recall attending a seminar on cognitive science at MIT some years ago, conducted by the linguist Noam Chomsky and the philosopher Jerry Fodor, in which the audience was regularly regaled with hilarious refutations of cognitive scientists from elsewhere who did not meet with their approval. On this day, Roger Schenck, the director of Yale University's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, was the bête noire, and, if you went by Chomsky's version, Schenck had to be some kind of flaming idiot. I knew Roger and his work pretty well, and though I had disagreements of my own with it, I thought that Noam's version was hardly recognizable. So I raised my hand and suggested that perhaps he didn't appreciate some of the subtleties of Roger's position. "Oh, no," Noam insisted, chuckling. "This is what he holds." And he went back to his demolition job, to the great amusement of those in the room. After a few more minutes of this, I intervened again. "I have to admit," I said, "that the views you are criticizing are simply preposterous." And Noam grinned affirmatively. "But then what I want to know is why you're wasting your time and ours criticizing such junk." It was a pretty effective pail of cold water. What about my own reductios of the views of others? Have they been any fairer? Here are a few to consider. You decide. The French neuroscientist Jean-Pierre Changeux and I once debated neuroscientist Sir John Eccles and philosopher Sir Karl Popper about consciousness and the brain at a conference in Venice. Changeux and I were the materialists, who maintain that the mind is the brain, and Popper and Eccles the dualists, who claim that a mind is not a material thing like a brain, but some other second kind of entity that interacts with the brain. Eccles had won the Nobel Prize many years earlier for the discovery of the synapse, the microscopic gap between neurons that glutamate molecules and other neurotransmitters and neuromodulators cross trillions of times a day. According to Eccles, the brain was like a mighty pipe organ, and the trillions of synapses composed the keyboards. The immaterial mind, the immortal soul, according to Eccles, a devout Catholic, played the synapses by somehow encouraging quantum-level nudges of the glutamate molecules. Forget all that theoretical discussion of neural networks and the like. It's irrelevant rubbish, he said. The mind is in the glutamate. When it was my turn to speak, I said I wanted to be sure I had understood his position. If the mind was in the glutamate, and I poured a bowl of glutamate down the drain, Would that not be murder? Well, he replied, somewhat taken aback, it would be very hard to tell, wouldn't it? You would think that Sir John Eccles, the Catholic dualist, and Francis Crick, the atheist materialist, would have very little in common aside from their Nobel Prizes. But at least for a while, their respective views of consciousness shared a dubious oversimplification. Many non-scientists don't appreciate how wonderful oversimplifications can be in science. They can cut through the hideous complexity with a working model that is almost right, postponing the messy details until later. Arguably, the best use of oversimplification in the history of science was the end run by Crick and James Watson to find the structure of DNA, while Linus Pauling and others were trudging along trying to make sense of all the details. Crick was all for trying the bold stroke just in case it solved the problem in one fell swoop. But of course, that doesn't always work. I was once given the opportunity to demonstrate this at one of Crick's famous teas at La Jolla. These afternoon sessions were informal lab meetings where visitors could raise issues and participate in the general discussion. On this particular occasion, Crick made a bold pronouncement. It had recently been shown that neurons in the cortical area V4 cared about, responded differentially to, color. And then he proposed a strikingly simple hypothesis. The conscious experience of red, for instance, was activity in the relevant red-sensitive neurons of that retinal area. I wondered. Are you saying, then, that if we were to remove some of those red-sensitive neurons and keep them alive in a petri dish and stimulate them with a microelectrode, there would be a consciousness of red in the petri dish? One way of responding to a proffered reductio is to grasp the nettle and endorse the conclusion, a move I once dubbed outsmarting, since the Australian philosopher J.J.C. Smart was famous for saying that, yes, according to his theory of ethics, it was sometimes right to frame and hang an innocent man. Crick decided to outsmart me. Yes, it would be an isolated instance of consciousness of red. Whose consciousness of red? He didn't say. He later refined his thinking on this score, but still he and neuroscientist Christoph Koch, in their quest for what they called the NCC, the neural correlates of consciousness, never quite abandoned their allegiance to this idea. Perhaps yet another encounter will bring out better what is problematic about the idea of a smidgen of consciousness in a dish. The physicist and mathematician Roger Penrose and the anesthesiologist Stuart Hameroff teamed up to produce a theory of consciousness that depended not on glutamate, but on quantum effects in the microtubules of neurons. Microtubules are